Okay, I am recording. This is Michelle DeMeo. I'm here with my colleague David Caruso, and we are in La Jolla, California on June 3rd, 2024, with Charles Cochran. Charlie, could we begin by asking you to tell us some basic information about where you were born and when?
Born in Berkeley, California, in 1930.
Okay, and who were your parents?
They were Adelaide and Eric Cochran. He came over from England as a young child and lived in Fresno, California, and then went to the University of California in Berkeley. And that's where he met my mother.
Why did your father come from England to the United States?
His family had moved over.
Okay. And did you have other siblings as well?
He had three brothers.
Okay. And your mother?
My mother had six siblings.
Oh, goodness,
She
yeah.
was the eldest of all of them.
And they're both from where in England?
My father was from Bristol.
You mentioned that Berkeley is where your parents met. Was your mother attending college as well?
She was also at the University of California, and that's where she met my father.
And what were your parents studying in college?
Just a variety of things. I don't think anything in any major in particular. But he went on in 1929 and opened a business of investing for personnel for clients
Okay.
in 1929, which was about a year before the Depression occurred.
Gosh, yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Stories you may have heard about the
Oh, yeah, well,
struggles?
he had terrible struggles. And in fact, at one point he was having such trouble he had to move down to Mexico
Oh, wow.
for about 6 months to a year and then come back because he just had to get away from it all.
Was there a business reason in Mexico, or it was just
No,
too?
just
Okay.
had to escape.
Got it.
But he was certainly a good father to have, and I had a good mother. We had a very close family.
Did you have brothers and sisters as
Yes,
well?
I had an elder brother.
Okay. What's the age difference?
Two years.
And you mostly grew up in Berkeley then?
Yes.
Until what age?
Till I was 19, and then I went
Okay.
to college in the East. My brother had gone also at about the same age to Yale.
What kind of schools did you attend when you were a child before you moved to Rochester?
Just high school.
Was it a public
Yeah,
or
Berkeley High School,
private?
public high
Berkeley,
school.
Berkeley Public, okay. Could you tell us a little bit more about that experience? Did you enjoy it? Were you active with sports? Were you advanced in your classes? Any favorite classes?
Well, I can tell you about the sports. I like to play tennis. I was
Yeah.
on the tennis team. And we lived right near the Berkeley Tennis Club, so I could spend time there playing with others and taking lessons and that sort of thing. But Berkeley High was Berkeley High School that both my brother and I attended. It was a good high school, and it trained kids to go on to college.
So you most of your friends also went to college.
Yes.
And at that time, did you know what you wanted to pursue, or it was more general education? You just knew you wanted to go to college, or did you have a sense of your career path?
No, I just to go on to college, and but it was in college I decided to go into the field of medicine.
Dave, do you want to ask any follow-ups on that before we talk about?
Sure. So can you just tell me a little bit more what it was like growing up in Berkeley during the Depression? I'm always curious to know how families fared. You mentioned that your father had this business. It didn't go well. He went to Mexico for several months. Did you go with him? Did you stay at home? If you were home, how was your family bringing the money? I just want to know a little bit more about those early years.
No, both my brother and I stayed at home, and my father wanted my mother to go with him, but she would not leave her children. But we stayed there, and I must say that I was unaware of many of the things that was happening because I was that young. And but I know that my parents would have somebody come and help in the house, and they had to select people who were not in trouble because of the Depression. And we had good people that came, and I remember some of them.
Did your mother work as well?
No, she did not. In those days, the mothers did not work. They stayed at home and to take care of the children. So my mother was with us all the time. And my father would come home.
Sorry,
and we'd take... He was particularly good about taking us up into the mountains as a father. And my mother would come along, and we would go up and spend a week or a month, actually, in the Sierras. And then as time went on, he would take my brother and me up into the Sierra, and we would go in on horseback into the upper regions. And that's something that stayed with me, so that when I came back after finishing medical school and going into research, I would take members of my laboratory up there who wanted to go. Well, they all wanted to go. And so I'd have 25 kids going up. We would drive up and to the eastern side of the Sierra and go in, I would rent horses for people to ride in if they wanted to. And I always walked in, go over a pass down the other side and spend about 5 or 6 days there just going fishing and just enjoying the beauty of the Sierra, and then we'd all come back. I remember I would have meetings every now and then of getting them all together, and one of them said at one of our meetings that he thought that the trips into the Sierra was the best part of his education.
When you were taking these trips, were you living off the land completely?
Into the Sierra? Yes. We'd have to take all the food in with us, because we'd go into the back country and there's nobody there. Mm-hmm. There would be just lakes and rivers and that sort of thing.
So during these trips, did your father try to... So when I was growing up, I was a Boy Scout, and so used to go on camping trips. That's where I learned how to start fires using sticks. That's where I learned how to, chop wood, things like that. Were you doing those things, those types of things on the trips as well?
Or
was
it
mostly just horseback riding, hiking, sort of stuff?
When we were there, we had to make fires to cook food and that sort of thing. So my knowledge that I got from my father paid off. I could use that to do what was necessary. And then the people in the camp all got used to doing that too.
After the time that your father was in Mexico, when he came back to the United States, did he go back to his previous business or did he launch a new endeavor?
Back to his previous business and formed a group. The three of them worked together. It was called Cochran, Meehan, and Eyre. And they would... My father spent most of the time, Ayer was a very wealthy guy and didn't do much at all. But my father built the clients up and he had many of them who appreciated what he could do and did do for them.
What industry were his clientele in?
I really cannot tell you. Okay. They were from all sorts of things. They're like in Piedmont, California, they were wealthy people and who needed to get their money invested for them, which is what he did.
Sure, yeah.
I met some interesting people, his clients.
Which ones? Do you want to talk about any?
Well, I just met them and it was fun to meet them and talk to them and get along.
Maybe that was some form of inspiration for you, perhaps, in your career long term, do you think?
That's a good point, and I think it probably was an inspiration. Number one, how to treat the clients.
From those early years, so you went hiking the Sierras, you were at home living in Berkeley. What was the area like? Were you and your brother the only kids around? Were there other kids in the neighborhood that you went out to play with?
No, we had many friends there. And in fact, I started playing tennis as an 11-year-old. And would go to the Berkeley Tennis Club and play there with other kids. And we became very good friends as children, playing tennis and trying to beat each other and going to school at the same time. I would go to, in the middle school, as soon as the bell rang, I'd be headed for the tennis club and to play tennis with other guys. And that worked out fine until I got a C in Latin. My mother said, "You're coming home after school." So I had to come home and not play tennis. But I played tennis really for the rest of my life until just recently.
Oh.
And now too weak to hit the ball and run and that sort of thing.
So in addition to tennis, what other things outside of school were you doing? Let's say in the evenings, were you an avid reader? Did you and your brother play stickball in the street? What were some of the other activities you engaged with as a young child?
I think reading and we would have groups of kids that would get together and do various things, which was really a pleasure.
Were you close with your brother? I'm sorry. Were you close with your brother?
Oh, yes.
Because 2 years difference,
yes.
So, yeah.
In fact, he went to Yale, and then I went to Rochester in upstate New York. And I used to go, if I had a few extra days, I'd go take the train down to and go get to New Haven through New York and spend time with him and his friends. They all lived on the campus at Yale. And so I got to meet them and made some very close friends, which was a pleasure. Oh, yeah. Something else I did as a youngster was to collect butterflies. And I had a butterfly net and I would use chloroform in a bottle to be able to take the butterflies. And I made collections of them and put them in a container that my father got and provided. So it was a pleasure. And then I learned the names of all the butterflies, which of course I've forgotten, except for monarchs and swallowtails.
How old were you when you were doing that?
I was in lower middle school,
okay.
So I suppose I was about 12, starting to do that. And I did it through high school because going out into fields where there are flowers with a butterfly net and catching them. You're in the fields and you're enjoying the flowers, you're enjoying the whole thing, as well as catching the butterflies. And I would only catch butterflies that I didn't have.
Okay. How big was your collection?
I think there were about 35 different species of butterflies. And the other thing is growing orchids. My father took my brother, and then when he graduated from high school, and then when I did, he took me too. But when he took him east to school, he had a orchid house built for me, which was it was about 12 feet by 12 feet a square, and all covered and connected. And so I started getting orchid plants, and I went and found a producer of orchids in Berkeley, and I could get little beginning orchid plants from him and then grow them up. And so it was a pleasure to see the orchids really develop and grow. And I think the whole family did, because they could cut the orchids and take them in the house and as flowers in the house. That was one of the really pleasurable things. Of course, when I graduated from high school, he also took me to the East, and we went first of all, to Rochester to see the various things that were there, and then to Boston, down to New York, and see the historical things in all of that area. So my father did a lot for both my brother and me, getting us going. As did my mother. She was a marvelous person who, during the Depression, people would come on to the front door and knock on it who were in hunger. And she would say, of course, just go around the back and sit on the stairs there, and she would bring them out a meal to eat. And then they would eat that meal and thank her and leave. But this was the Depression.
Oh my goodness.
And I remember those conditions. It was just a horrible time.
In the evenings when you were young and your family was home, did you all eat dinner together?
Oh, we did. Always ate dinner. And my mother always cooked it.
Mm.
And over dinner, what did your family talk about? Were there discussions of politics or religion? Was it chatting with the kids about what they learned at school? What did your family discuss while they were having your meals?
Sort of things, what happened to the kids during the day at school and other things. And we would get into laughter and had good times together. And those times were a real pleasure.
As you were getting older, let's say sort of mid-1930s, later 1930s, let me ask this first. Did your father still have family in England?
No, they were all in this country and in different parts. A couple of them stayed in Fresno and one was down in Los Angeles. And he knew them and stayed in contact.
Because what I was going to ask was, as we get into the late 1930s, Germany, rise of Hitler, war was kind of going to be happening, starting. So I didn't know if you had family in England still that was impacted, and whether or not your family discussed that level of politics or the beginnings of what came to be World War II.
No, the family had all come out, so they were not there, and that was, I'm sure, a relief to all of them. Because there was the possibility the Germans, as you know, would cross the English Channel and come into England to try to capture England. So that was a good thing that we did, or they did what they did, namely leave England.
Do you remember hearing anyone talking about that in your household, the war coming, or how it was impacting your family?
Yeah, they talked about it all the time.
Yeah.
My father, in fact, went back to New York to try to see if he could help by, we started flying things over to England to help them, food and all sorts of things, and maybe even munitions. And he wanted to fly with them to help take things to England, since he came from there. Mm. But he couldn't, and he had to get back on the train and come back to Berkeley.
And what was it like once the U.S. declared war in the 1940s? Did things change for you at all around your home?
They sure did. There was a concern that the... Monica, there's a... on the screen just came on.
Oh. Michelle needs to look at that. Michelle.
Oh.
Charlie, that's really interesting too. December 7th, when you were on the bay and a little kid.
Yeah. Monica just reminded me that you asked about the beginning of the war. We were fishing with a friend of my family, who took us over to shallow areas in San Francisco and that go up like little rivers into the backcountry. But those were good places to fish that he knew about. So as a little kid, he took me over along with my father. And we fished during the day, and that was December 7th. And we came back, and he had been in charge of a submarine in World War I. And so he knew the military. He came back, we came back home, and we let him out of the car. And his wife came screaming out to say that the Japanese had just attack Pearl Harbor. Ugh. And that started then a whole series of things. We had no way of keeping the Japanese away from us. And they could have come in and bombed our San Francisco Bay Area. So we had we had to drop our lights at night in the houses, which we all did, and then constantly watching to see if airplanes came in from the west that would be bombing. And that went on for quite a while until we started building up the ability to keep them from attacking very, very quickly. But I say very quickly, and yet it took some time to do that while we were working quickly. The government was working quickly with the practically no military that we had. Yeah. So that was those were unique times that I will never come back.
Did you have folks close to you who were joined the military?
Yes, and we had a guy who was Philippines who worked in our house and help with the dishes and take care of things. And he went into the service, and so we put in those days, if you had somebody who went into the service, you'd put a star on your window, a blue star. If he got killed, you'd turn it to a gold star. And we had a blue star for this guy, Marciano, when he went into the military.
Did he return to your house after the war?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
What else do you remember kind of changing around that time for you? Did things at school change? Were you, going through air raid drills? Was the education changing? What was it like being a young student at that period of time?
Well, I think there was just a constant awareness of of the war, and every now and then there would be concerned that an airplane was coming in to drop bombs, and so the air raid sirens would go off all over town. And those were scary because you didn't know whether or not there'd be a bomber coming in. Of course, you were supposed to go down into in the basement of the schools to avoid being killed by the bombs. So that kind of scariness did take place.
While you were in class and you weren't going into these drills or there weren't sirens going off, did the education that you received change at all? Were teachers teaching you about the war, or was it just like your standard curriculum
curriculum? Some of the teachers had gone to be in the service, so we were down some of that. Also, if there was a potential bombing coming in the school, we'd all go running out the doors and down for protection, get out of the classroom. Interesting days, scary days, as you can see.
While you were in school, were there classes that you liked more than others? Were you a history buff, math person, or were you very comfortable with all the different things that you were learning?
Science. I liked the various courses that they offered in various aspects of the scientific area, and those were good.
Could you tell us more about your science education? Did you have a lab at school? Did you have...
No, it was strictly classes.
Just classes.
And we would learn the class and then take tests. This was Berkeley High School. And they did have a variety of scientific courses to take. But I also liked the history courses. Those were good. My brother loved history, and that's what he went into. When he went to Yale, he majored in history. So with him loving history, I liked it too.
And so as you're progressing through high school, you're involved in tennis. I forget if you mentioned this was middle school or high school. You weren't performing as well as you should have been in Latin, so you were pulled away from tennis for a little bit. But were there other activities that you enjoyed participating in during middle school, during high school, performing in school musicals or plays? Were you part of any other clubs or have other activities that you engaged with? Like, did you have a part-time job? What else was going on for you during your high school years?
Well, there was a club called Unoia, E-U-N-O-I-A. And that was a group from each class that we had about, I suppose, 30 in the entire group, but from 9th through 12th grade. And these were particularly good people, and coming in the 9th grade, you were exposed to those in the 12th grade who would talk about things that they like to do and that you might like to do. So you learn what's good in the coming years, and it helps you decide what to do and what courses to take. So that was, my brother was in that same group 2 years ahead of me. So that was a good thing to do. It's just a shame that there weren't more students in these groups, especially kids who did not have much money. And I remember, or black kids, and I remember it when I was in my junior year there, about 11th grade, trying to convince people in the club, the Anoia Club, to take in a black boy that I knew and became friendly with and have him come into the club, but they wouldn't do it. And that made me angry. I'm always believing in inclusion and that people should not be considered different.
So the Anoia Club had boys and girls?
No, just boys.
It was just boys, and it was primarily white boys?
Exactly.
Exclusively white. Yeah, okay.
And then there were girls' clubs, too.
Mm.
So the boys, girls, the boys' clubs and the girls' clubs used to have times together.
Dave was asking about your high school more generally, the demographic makeup. Did you have black, Latino students?
Oh, there were some blacks. Berkeley had on the west side next to the bay, were mostly people without much funds, low income, were staying, and these generally were people of color. In those days, I would do everything I could to turn it around, and still do.
So when you were entering high school, your brother was already a couple of years in. You mentioned that he went to Yale, you went to Rochester. During high school years, did your family start talking about college?
Yes.
Opportunities, yeah. Expectations, since you did wind up both going to the East Coast, was that intentional on your family's part or just happenstance?
It, with my brother, it was happenstance, and since he went East, I thought it would be great for me to do too. And that's why I applied to the University of Rochester.
Have you been out East already?
Yes, my, well, no, I hadn't been east until I was until I graduated from high school. And then my father took me on the train to Chicago and then on to the East Coast, which was just delightful. A real eye-opener.
How so?
Yeah, well, I got to see things in Boston and New York and see what it's like there with the high buildings it was and the big parks like Central Park, which we walked through, and then the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You know, as a youngster, I hadn't seen anything like that.
Did you visit your brother at Yale?
Yes, I'd go down, as I mentioned, when I had an extra day, like a 3-day weekend, I would take the train down to New York and then up to New Haven. And that's when I got to, I would see him, but I'd really spend most of my time with his pals.
And did you, when you settled on the Rochester, could you tell us more about that? Were there other universities you were considering? Did you consider Yale as well, or you wanted to do something different? Did you have a clue what career path you wanted yet?
Well, I liked science, and I thought maybe medicine would be a good thing to do. And they had, I could take courses there, either at Yale or in Rochester. But I thought it would be good to go to a new university, and one that not many people knew about. So that was Rochester.
So that begs the question, how did you know about Rochester?
I had a friend who had gone there and liked it a lot. So, of course, I was making the decision without much knowledge about it, the school, and how good it was, or myself and how good I was. So I... and I wouldn't be getting a C in Latin, hopefully. So at any rate, I went off to the university there and then stayed on to the medical school because the medical school was really good.
What was Rochester as a city like?
It was, that was Eastman Kodak that put lots of money into it. So they also built the campus, the undergraduate campus, and put all the money into the buildings that went there. And that's why, and a lot of it was in, they built for science. But that, with Eastman Kodak and all the good things that there were, there was a big boulevard that had all these wealthy people living on it, who were working at Eastman Kodak. And the, you know, you see those things, and it's kind of a stimulant to them, and others don't like it, but I like it. And I met some of the people who lived there while I was in college.
When you matriculated to the university, you mentioned that your father took you on this trip, visiting various sites on the East Coast. Once you were left at the university and he headed home, what was it like transitioning into college for you? Did you struggle at all with the distance away that you were from Berkeley when winter hit? Was that a bit of a surprise for you? What was it like becoming a college student living kind of on your own and being in this northeastern environment?
I loved it. And when we'd have a snowstorm, I loved that. I just couldn't stop looking at the snow outside the windows, or walking around in it, or making snowballs, which I'd never considered doing. And we would have snowball fights, the other kids. And I joined a fraternity there, Delta Kappa Epsilon, which happened to be the same fraternity my father was in at the University of California, Berkeley. And I joined that in the end of my freshman year. And so again, a series of good friends that were there. And then we had a reunion, a 50-year reunion, and Monica went back with me and saw the fraternity house and a bunch of the people who were there, and saw Coakdale's pee in his pants. He was a football player who was a tremendous football player, but he got boomed in the head, and at one point he was unconscious. And that kind of damage had its effect for later life. And we saw that in him that time at the 50th anniversary. He was unable to talk much with people, and he peed in his pants. That's an evidence of damage that can occur as a young person. That's why I learned later that high school kids should not play football, because they are especially damaged subject to trauma.
They
still do play high school football, and I know everybody comes to see that. But from it, it's going to come damaged heads.
Did you live in a fraternity house from your last 4 years, sophomore, junior, senior year?
Sophomore, junior, we had to live in the dorms as freshmen, and I did that, and then moved after I think it was the sophomore year that I moved into the, it could have been the junior year, moved into the fraternity. And there we, you know, if you're rooming with a certain person, you get to know them really well. And I did. I lived, roomed with a guy named Binkmeyer, and then both of us went on to medical school. And I went really to the University of Rochester because the dean of it was a man named George Whipple. And he'd been in San Francisco, but he did not want to go back and start a medical school until they really got after him. Some of the senior people from Kodak and so forth got him to start a medical school, because with a medical school, it would add so much to the city of Rochester, and it did. Even we had classes of about 70 students per class, all men, and it wasn't until my third year that they allowed two women to come in to the class.
When did the school start?
Now it's 50-50.
Okay. When did the school start, the medical school at Rochester? He's working on. You said Whipple was pressured by Kodak to create this school in Rochester and bring the money. When was that?
Oh, I think probably about 10 years before I went to the school. So about 1940-something.
So you're one of the earlier cohorts then, when you went there for medical school in 1950, 51?
51.
Yeah.
Well, it was well developed, and they had a marvelous faculty, and caring for patients and so forth was just well developed, because they brought in people from all of the medical schools around to be there. The other schools loved the other professors loved coming there to be the professor there.
Can you tell me a little bit, you had this potential interest in medicine. When you started your freshman year, what courses were you taking?
Took anatomy and biochemistry. We had just a few, and then we would switch the next year. But the anatomy lasted for a year, and so we learned all the anatomy of the body by dissecting a human body, and then taking biochemistry at the same time. And what the chemistry
was. Was this as an undergraduate or in medical school?
I'm sorry, in medical school.
So I was wondering what classes you were taking when you entered as an undergraduate. Since you had the interest in medicine, was there a curriculum that was focused on people who might pursue medicine as a degree, or was it more of a liberal arts education?
It was a combination of the two, but there were scientific classes that I could take that were like what was called chordate anatomy, which is the anatomy of animals that have spinal columns. And we did that course in chordate anatomy. Also, the chemistry courses were related to there were biology courses as well, and then chemistry courses that related to the chemistry of the body. So those were eye openers to go into medical school.
Was your first?
Go ahead, Michelle.
I was just going to ask about your education. Was your undergrad education your first time working in a laboratory setting, or did you have to wait till you got to medical school?
We did laboratory work in the chemistry courses, and in biology. But it really came to life in medical school.
What sort of experiments were you performing in those laboratory classes?
Putting together chemicals that would then produce something that we knew existed, but it was to show us how that final product was made. And, I can't remember much more than that to answer your question.
Sure. In addition to joining a fraternity, were there other activities that you were doing in addition to taking your classes?
I was on the tennis team.
So there was an official tennis team at the university?
Oh, yes. And we would take on tennis teams from other universities too. So I got to meet a bunch of young people from other schools that and get to know them, which was a pleasure, even though I tried to beat them on the tennis court.
And if what I read is correct, you played in the number one position for three straight years from your sophomore to your senior year?
It was really my sophomore, junior, and senior year that happened. And what I really learned was the courts that we had there were asphalt, so they weren't smooth cement. And when I got into playing on the number one court, there was a fence right next to it that had rose bushes on it. So I learned to serve if I throw the ball behind me and hit it so that the ball was going like this, it would hit the court and go right at the rose bush. And in order for my opponent to get it, he'd go right into the rose bush. He'd be pulling this.
And had you ever considered potentially pursuing tennis professionally?
You know, not really, because I wanted to go into medicine, and tennis was something that was on the side, and it was a real pleasure. In medical school, in the winter, we couldn't play because there was snow all over the surface. But I learned to play squash, which was an indoor game, and we could play that, and that was a different kind of game and so forth, but similar with a racket and balls and learning to hit the ball. So that was a good, you know, when you're going to school full time and you're taking lots of courses and then you're going to be working all night on the homework, getting out of class and then getting some exercise and like playing squash was a real pleasure.
So as you're progressing through your undergraduate education, let me ask you this. How many courses were you taking per semester?
About five courses per semester in various areas. From I took courses in German, I took courses in science, and then courses in biology, and courses in history. I took them all.
Okay. Just a quick question, since this is also after the GI Bill, were there any World War II vets in your class?
There were in medical school.
Okay. All right, so but not an undergraduate. At the end of your freshman year, did you travel home for the summer, or did you stay in Rochester?
No, I came home for the summer.
And during that summertime period, what were you doing when you were home? Was it just a period of time to relax? Did you get a summer job?
Yeah, I'd get a summer job. Usually over in San Francisco, and I'd take the train over. And my father knew various companies that were involved in doing work to help, work investment business. And so I could get a job in one of those because they knew my father, and that got me a job. But it was, you know, then I'd be over in San Francisco and I could get to walk around during lunchtime and see things and learn more and more about San Francisco, which was good.
And so then, was this the same for your sophomore and junior years, where you returned home during the summer, took a job?
Yeah.
So, when you started to think about medical schools, were you already set on applying to the University of Rochester, or were you going to use this as an opportunity to maybe explore a different portion of the country and education?
I wanted to go straight into George Whipple's school.
And in fact, Rochester have a program where it was sort of an easy path for undergraduates to go into the medical school there, or was it a traditional application process and you had to be accepted?
The undergraduate school was strictly separate, and each course was, nobody talked about going to the University of Rochester School of Medicine.
So were you one of the only ones in your cohort that went to Whipple's school?
Well, my roommate, Dick Bickmeyer, he went to those. There were several who went on to the university, to the medical school.
And the rest of your colleagues, or your student mates, when you went to graduate school then were very different, it sounds like. You had a few people you knew, but did you say your class was about 75 or so?
In medical school, 70.
And a lot of people from different areas that you did not go to undergraduate.
From all over.
Right. Was it international as well, or just national?
No, just national.
Yeah. Did you continue to live on campus in a...
Always. No, not in medical school.
Okay.
In medical school, we had to live in the neighborhood, so... Okay. And it was easy to find places to live.
Did you have your own place, or did you roommate with your old friends?
Well, we had three of us in the house that we lived in.
All medical students?
Yes.
Yep.
And different years.
Oh, okay. So what was it like going from undergraduate education to medical school? Was it more coursework? Was it longer days? Tell us a little bit about how the education system started to change for you.
It was pretty much the same quality. But everything we were doing in medical school involved things we needed to learn and keep in our brains. So in order to go into medicine, and that was quite different. And we were all together, I mean, the whole gang, as opposed to undergraduate, where people were going to be doing different things. But, and a very high quality of classmates in medical school.
What about the professors? High quality?
Oh, yes.
Who were some of your favorites that you worked with in medical school?
In the professors or the courses?
Both, yeah.
Certainly pathology was one. And...
what did you like about pathology?
Teachers, the professors were very high rate and worked very carefully with the students. What we were learning was everything about the human body and what happens when you get diseases, what it does to the various parts of the body. So I was learning a lot about what we would need to know in the coming years, not just a segment, like being for pediatric or gynecology and so forth, which is a part of medicine that you're learning. This was everything.
You mentioned that your first year was a year of anatomy. And what other courses were you taking?
I have to think back. I guess I needed a course in memory.
You mentioned biochemistry.
Yeah, biochemistry. It's difficult for me to recall the exact courses.
Sure. And as you were, so when you came into medical school, you wanted to be a physician. Did you have any sense of what you might want to, or if you wanted to specialize in medicine, were you looking to be a general practitioner? Were you waiting to get through medical school to figure out what you might want to specialize in? You know, what was it like? What were your initial ideas about what your future profession was going to be once you became a physician?
That's a good question and an important one for me, because I wanted to go into internal medicine, like a general practitioner, because you're seeing all the different kinds of things that adversely affect human beings. So there was a choice of classes that you could take in the third and fourth years, and I did those that would help me get into internal medicine.
I wonder, did that spark maybe that interest in pathology and enjoying those classes? Was that a natural extension from that?
Just a natural change.
Yeah. So what kinds of third and fourth year courses did you have to take to get into internal medicine?
I'll have to take that course in memory again.
That's fine.
But I just don't remember the courses. We took courses in for gastroenterology and cardiology and neurology.
Yeah, it's really a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
so what happened? No, go ahead, sorry.
The teachers we had were specialized in those areas.
So what happened that you changed your mind about going into internal medicine?
And going into science?
You had planned to go into internal medicine, but then you didn't. So what happened to change your mind?
I left medical school with the idea that I would go into internal medicine, and patients had problems that of which there was no real answer, and I thought, gosh, maybe they are they have immunologic reactions to themselves, autoimmunity that is causing these problems, loss of vision, loss of hearing, and that sort of thing. So I decided to, when I left the medical school, to go into learning immunology, and I looked around the country to find places where it was done, and there was really only one place that had anything serious in immunology, and that was a terrible university, third-rate university medical school, which was the University of Pittsburgh. But there were five young people, average, I think I've written this, average age was 29, and they were a Department of Immunology, and so I went there. And
so you finished medical school in, was it 55? With a medical degree, right?
Yes.
And then you were looking, and then you went to the University of Pittsburgh. Was this like a postdoc or?
Yeah.
It was, okay. And that was 56, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you go, yeah, so tell us a bit about this then, this experience. You're at Pittsburgh now. How different is this from Rochester? What are the classes like, the campus, the opportunities? Tell us a little
bit
about
what you experienced.
Well, I didn't.
When I went there, I didn't have a job. I didn't have a position in the university, so I could just do research. And what I did was to start doing work in the laboratory that was similar to some of the others, and this was doing antigens and antibodies, and then after a year of doing that, government established the National Institutes of Health, and they would give funds to do research based upon an application he had sent them. So amongst the others, I was one who also sent an application to get funds for the things I was doing with antigens and antibodies, and I got a grant, and so that paid my salary, and for all the things I needed in the laboratory, even though I was getting them from the head of the institution where I went, the head of the department.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm wondering. You didn't have a job. You were just doing research. Did you have a professor who said you could join his research group?
Oh, yes, yes.
Who was that?
Frank Dixon.
Okay. And how did you know Frank Dixon?
Well, this was the group of five that I visited when I went around trying to find some areas doing immunology.
And he said, if you come here, you can use my lab, work with me. And
well, he had several labs that were there. And so I got to use one lab. And I didn't, after about 6 months, I saw areas that I would like to work in, and they would require learning how to do things that the others weren't doing. One of them was using this fluorescent antibodies, and you take an antibody molecule and tag it with a fluorescent substance. So if you look at it under ultraviolet light on a microscope, you can see where that protein was. And so I started doing that, and the one who invented that system of fluorescent antibodies was a man named Albert Koons from Boston, from Harvard, and I got to know him. And I was the only one in the lab of the various people using the fluorescent antibody to look at things, and I did it to the various tests that I was doing in experimental animals.
Mm-hmm. Was this is the work that was supported by the NIH?
Yes.
And who else was working with you on that project? Dixon?
Well, no, I'd be working on it alone.
Was your own, okay?
Because I had my own grant. Mm-hmm. But the others in the group were a guy named William Weigel and Joe Vasquez. A young fellow named Barry Pierce from Canada.
And what were their roles? Could you tell us a little bit about what...
They were doing completely different.
They were?
Yeah.
Okay.
And one named Joe Feldman. And then Frank Dixon was the chairman of the department. Mm-hmm. And after... Well, one of the years... I had permission to take it to move to a different place to learn from different scientists new things that I then could apply to my own research. And so I looked around and I decided to go to the Pasteur Institute.
Oh, right.
L'Institut Pasteur à Paris. Mm-hmm. And so I had to learn French to go there. And I took courses at one of these schools that teach foreign languages and for 6 months. And I went over to Paris and I didn't understand one word anybody said. But I, out at the end, when I got to Institut Pasteur, I would speak English. They all spoke English. And then when I got so I could speak a little more French than they spoke English, we switched over entirely. And that was really good. And since I had an NIH grant and we were and had been doing science for quite a while before, I actually knew more science than they did.
Well, how long were you on the NIH grant for in Pittsburgh? 1 year, 2 years?
2 years.
Okay. And then did you have to publish anything at the end of that time?
Didn't have to, but I did.
What was that publication?
Well, it was about antigen antibody complexes. And the first ones were with Bill Weigel. I have them all in the other room there.
And is, then, is that your first publication?
Yeah.
1957, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I learned that you should always have the chairman of the department on too, so we put Frank Dixon's name on as well.
I see, yeah, but he wasn't actively involved, yeah. But you have to do that right.
Mm-hmm. But over at Paris, I then got so I spoke more French than they did English, and we speak entirely French. And then, in fact, I was asked to give lectures on my work there at the Pasteur and then down in Lyon. And that was a real pleasure to give lectures in French.
So this was 1959, I think. So you spent 2 years in Pittsburgh. You've got your first publication, and then you decided to go to Paris,
yes.
The Pasteur Institute. Did you know someone there already?
No. No. And they were all new, and just delightful people. And one of the things we did was they'd have. This is a joke. Friday afternoons, we'd all have a cup of tea together in the director's, the head of a guy named Pierre Gravard, in his secretary's office, and we would all go in and talk with each other, which was a real pleasure. And then every now and then somebody would tell a funny story. And one day he told a funny story, and I understood one side of the meaning, which was not terribly funny, but they were all laughing off their heads at what he had said. And so it was a naughty side that I did.
Sure.
So when everybody left, the secretary came over and whispered in my ear what the naughty side was.
Nice. That is one of those struggles, right? You can learn enough professionally to get by in the lab, but it is those moments that happen at tea or at the bar afterwards that, you know, when you start to really forge friendships with people, and
yeah.
I could imagine the language is a bit of a difficulty there for you.
So that was a great year being over there and then learning what France was like and meeting
sure.
French people and going out to the Louvre, and it's not just science, it was being in the art world as well.
So your 1 year that you were there, could you tell me who you worked with in the end? What department were you at?
They had good people there, but they just weren't doing much science at all because they didn't have NIH grants.
Sure.
And they were just trying, that's why they thought what I was doing was so important.
Dave, I don't know if you want to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, one question that I have is, you know, we asked you about college experiences and labs. I know that in medical school you were taking part in certain types of labs, but you weren't trained as a traditional scientist, right? And I'm wondering, when you started doing research, how did you know what you should be doing in order to undertake that research? Had you ever worked with doing experiments in living animals, with extracting samples, with analyzing data, with, I don't even know what equipment was available to you in the lab. Were you familiar with that equipment? Like, how did you learn how to be not just a physician, but a scientist who was doing medical research?
Well, that's when I left medical school after graduation and went down to Pittsburgh, and they were all doing science there, and nothing but science in that group. And so I really learned how to put things together there with them.
So you were collaborating with them to figure out how to construct the experiments and
how
to run them?
Really, with a guy named one of them, Bill Weigel. And then I picked up things on my own after I got basic things together. And one was how to work with animals, if we were going to do studies on animals. And so I picked that up there as well.
And when you were undertaking this research, right, you'd mentioned that you had developed an interest in the body's responses. Were you thinking, you know, in addition to doing research, I still want to be a physician? Or were you now moving in a direction where it was like, I'm doing research, not necessarily so that way I can see patients, but because I'm interested in medical research?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Mm. I got so interested in the science that I couldn't get away from it. And everything is new. And when you get a new one, then you realize there's something even beyond that that you can get into. And that's what just kept me going. The other thing was that in science, especially after we moved out to the West Coast, I could have postdoctoral fellows come and join me. And we can get out of that in a minute. But that everything just builds on itself.
And when you were doing the scientific work, were you aware of any organizations out there with people who are doing things similar to you? I know eventually you join a lot of like societies, organizations that focus on various aspects of science, but were you aware of those organizations existing? Were you aware of other physician researchers who were, who maybe had a PhD in addition to their MD? Like, did you have any knowledge of who was out there?
Yeah, it was easy to do that because you go to meetings and people would be presenting their scientific work. And you'd go to the ones that are similar to your own, then you get to meet those other scientists who are doing similar but different work from your own, so that you could talk with them about how you're both going from that point on. So that really spread me out.
How did you find out about those meetings? Was it from colleagues?
Oh, no, they're big meetings that we'd all go to. They're put on every year and by organization, the same organization. And so we would all go to the meeting and spend 4 or 5 nights there staying and going to the meetings during the day. And then we'd really get to know the other ones who were working in similar areas, if not the same as our own. And you get to really get to know them and have good times together, not only in science, but having a good drink and dinner afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
Become really good friends.
And during this period of time, did you start to think about where you wanted to do the science that you were doing? Were you starting to, because you mentioned you went to Pittsburgh for a specific reason, right? It wasn't a top tier school, but there was a group of people there that was doing stuff that you were interested in. As you're pursuing this area of science, were you thinking about, you know, like you got a grant, so you're at Pittsburgh and you had this opportunity to go to the Institut Pasteur. Were there other places that you were considering going to?
Not really. I was asked to go to other couple of other places and go on their staff, but I wanted to stay exactly where I was and do the research I was doing, which was, after a year or so, was unique in the laboratory. I was doing things that nobody else did, so I got the grants that I was doing that nobody else was, and that made me a separate individual. Hmm. And this, when we then moved and came west, we can get into that, that became very important. Hmm.
When you applied to the Institut Pasteur, is that the right terminology? Did you apply to be hosted there? Did you have a job lined up? Like, how did you, I'm guessing you were writing letters back and forth to Paris?
Yes, I wrote to Pierre Grobar, who was the head of it, and told him that I'd like to come over and spend a year doing science with his people. And I was accepted by him. There were others I could go to who were probably more in the area that I was, but to go to Paris
sure.
and something completely different was something I chose to do.
Did it come with a financial package?
No,
you?
I brought
you,
all.
Yeah. Okay. Lab access.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it was 1 year.
Yes.
1959, when you decided to move out there and spend the year with them. Was it, I have the Department of Microbiological Chemistry. Is that where you started at in Paris?
In Paris, yes.
Yes, okay. And who did you work with there? Was there any...
Pretty much by myself. I worked in the laboratory with another very nice guy, but whose name is, I just can't pull up.
But he did his, he shared a laboratory, but not necessarily doing research with you. Is
right.
Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But what I tried to do was do the work that they're doing, and which was okay. I could do that. It wasn't terribly serious and that kind of work, and it wasn't immunology.
What was it?
I have to go back. And
okay. Did you get to do some of your immunology work while you were out there?
No, not really. I gave my talks in.
Okay.
In immunology, which they all like to hear something completely different. But I must say, getting to know the people there in Grobar's organization was a delight.
Good.
Such neat people.
So when you were, based on that experience and you're wrapping up 1960s, what are you starting to think about your career paths, or how do you want to grow from this experience that you had in Paris? What's going through your brain at this time?
Oh, well, I was doing my immunology, and the kinds of studies that I was interested in doing and did do, each one which was novel, and each one produced more novel things, so that's what was governing me. And it was starting with the antigen and antigen antibody complexes and the inflammation they produced. And then that got me into studies of inflammation. What was there in inflammation that was causing the damage? And I started that in Pittsburgh, and then, you know, I told you that we at the University of Pittsburgh, we all had grants, but the head of the president of the university wanted to take all of our grants through his office and be reviewed to decide whether we should get them or not. But we all gave him the middle finger.
Yeah.
And had left the University of Pittsburgh.
Okay.
I wonder if he realized the mistakes he made in losing this group. Because our group of five was producing so much science and in journals and so forth that we became very popular. And that's what also when we decided to leave the University of Pittsburgh. We had a number of different places that wanted to pick us up, but one of them that we did do was out here with Edmund Keeney at the Scripps Clinic.
That was, Dave, I don't know if you want to get into a Scripps Clinic or talk about the 1960s, or is there anything else we should cover?
That was 1961.
Yeah. Anything else to cover in the late 50s?
Nothing that was that came to my mind specifically. I mean, you did mention that there are places interested in these people from Pittsburgh, and I was curious to know, like, how did places reach out to you all to say, hey, look, we know you're at Pittsburgh, but you know, why don't you come here? How are you being contacted? How are people finding you?
Well, we would, I especially would be giving talks at these meetings. And so people would listen to the talk and they'd think, well, that's something that we'd like to have in our organization. So they would ask me to come to their organization. And, you know, there all kinds of really good universities that I could have gone to, but I wanted to stay right where I was and finish there.
That's all I wanted to ask, Michelle.
Okay. You mentioned working with, having your own postdocs. Did that happen for the first time in Paris, or was that when you came back?
When I came back and we moved.
Okay.
We moved out here to the California.
Okay, so let's turn to that time then. This is 1961, is it, when you decide to move back here? Tell us a little bit about what's happening.
That was the big year. Well, Ed Keeney, that's got a thing on the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't worry, when that comes up, it's still recording us.
Ed Keeney wanted us to, wanted to have some science along with the physicians in the Scripps Clinic. So we asked us to come out, and he built a new building for us with one extra floor. So we took floors 1 through 4, and then the fifth floor was on top, which I'll get to in a minute. And we each got labs there, and...
Who's we? You've been saying we.
Weigel, Feldman, Dixon, myself. And we went to work in our labs, and the idea was that... And he gave us a lunch to have with the clinicians, a free lunch. And we'd all come together, and he thought the clinicians who would have unsolved problems with their patients could then talk with the scientists and tell the scientists about the problems, and then the scientists could even do some studies to find out what the problems were with these patients. The difficulty that he faced was that when we scientists got together, we were talking our science with the others, and we couldn't stop talking. So yes, we met the clinicians and enjoyed being with them, but we didn't do much of what Ed Keeney wanted us to do. But Ed was a marvelous human being, and he really liked then having all the work we were doing, which were, and publishing papers, which was adding a lot of knowledge, a lot of it. The pleasure of people have in knowing about the Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation, which was what it was called. The other thing is that we were back in Pittsburgh. Jonas Salk was there, and he had his rhesus monkeys, and he vaccinated the rhesus monkeys with poliovirus, killed for poliovirus, and found that when he would challenge them with active polio, that they were resistant and not get the disease. And I got to know him there in Pittsburgh, which was a real pleasure. And then he moved out to the West Coast and had the fifth floor in our department. So he was there. He didn't do much work in that because they were building the Salk Institute up here, which is huge.
Did you first find out about the Scripps opportunity while you were in Paris? Or did you move back to Pittsburgh after Paris, or did you go directly
I went back to Pittsburgh.
Okay.
For the final year.
Okay.
And that's when we were making the decision.
And that's when you made the decision. Okay, yeah. And what was the reputation of Scripps like at this time? 1960, 61.
Zero. There was nothing there.
Right. So tell us more. Did that feel like it must have been exciting to be the start of something new? Maybe scary?
It was
getting
our new labs, and that were Because up in Pittsburgh, we were sort of working in a mixture. But there, each one of us had a lab. And we had, so this is the beginning of the growth of the Research Institute. We could grow because each of us had research grants. And we would continue to do our study in that area, and new areas kept bouncing, kept coming up, that we discovered that, gosh, these three things are saying that there's one more thing that's needed, and that's the fourth, but we need to learn about it. So then we would start doing studies in that fourth area, and we'd get a new grant to do that.
Is this NIH funding?
NIH funding. Yeah. Which we would apply to, and it's peer reviewed. So, and then I actually ended up being on one of the peer reviewers, which is a scientist going over other grant applications. But we then kept building that. And the other thing we put into our grant was that there were young people who wanted to come and work in our lab and find out what we were doing and learn what we were doing because they were interested in that. And these were the postdoctoral fellows. So they all had degrees. And so they would then work in our lab and learn what all the science was and build up that way. And so I would, in my grant applications, I would put more into it to bring in more postdoctoral fellows. There was one particularly good one. He was in England and he wanted to come over. His name was Roger Allen. And I didn't have a grant for him at the time. And I said, Roger, I'm sorry, I can't take you right now, but give me some time. And about 6 months later, I got a new grant that would funded another postdoctoral fellow. So I wrote him a letter and said, I've now got a grant, you can come. And he said, I can't believe it. He'd taken a different job, but he left that other job anyway and came out. And he was, I think, about 22 years old. And he came to the lab. I'd always, when they'd come to the lab as a postdoctoral fellow, I would tell them the various areas that were being done in the lab that they might be interested in, and they would select the area they'd like to be in. So Roger came and I said, he's very tall and one of the best looking guys I'd ever seen in my life. And I said, Roger, here are the various things that you could be interested in. And he made a selection. And then I noticed in the next 3 or 4 days, there were young women who kept coming to the lab that I'd never seen. They wanted to eyeball Roger Allen and maybe try to get to know him.
Right.
I tell you, he was just a fabulous guy. And we had I had such great interest in the postdocs, and they would get them, make sure they had their names on papers that were published, so that after 3 or 4 years they could get jobs on the staff of other universities, and that they did. They spread out all over the world. And then I had postdoctoral fellows coming from not only England but from Poland and Germany and France and England. And it was just,
well, let's talk a bit about that. You are running the Division of Experimental Pathology at this time at the Scripps Institute. Is that correct? The Division of Experimental Pathology, is that what you are?
Okay,
that's where you're based right now?
Yeah.
And are people finding you and writing to you? Are they including a sample of their writing or research and saying, would you consider me? Or do you have people in mind that you said, oh,
no,
I
they
know.
Would write
They're
to
writing
me.
To you.
I didn't
yeah.
know any of them.
Got it.
But they'd hear me give a talk or they'd uh-huh. read the articles I'd written. And so they wanted to come and learn about that.
So as far as Poland, people are hearing about your work and writing to you saying they want to come?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
And I was asked to give talks in Poland.
What other places? So England, Poland, where else is your work being respected and heard?
All over this country.
Okay.
But also Italy.
Yep.
So it was, became a worldwide, oh, and Japan. I have postdoctoral fellows there coming from Japan.
What piece of your work seems to be resonating with these international audiences? What's starting to really build your reputation?
Oh, just the studies we were, variety of studies we were doing in vitro in the lab, but also in experimental animals.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like? So you get to Scripps. Prior to being there, it sounded like you were an independent researcher, right? You had your money, you did your work, you published your results. You might have spoken with other people in the lab, you had learned some stuff from them in the early years, but you were the researcher doing your research. As you start to take on postdocs, as you're bringing people into your lab, does your role change with respect to the science that you are doing yourself, but also with regard to the people in your lab? Did you have to take on like management responsibilities to ensure that these postdocs were getting their work done? Were you overseeing their work, writing articles with them? How did the nature of the time that you committed to your own work change, if at all, with regard to having responsibilities for other people?
Well, you got to realize that the postdocs who were there were doing my research. So we did it together. And we were talking all the time. We had, on Mondays, there would be two or three who would give a talk about what they'd been doing. And I would also be giving talks like that on Monday mornings. So it was really sort of a combination, but each one was unique in what he or she were up to, and I was the same. So it was a real pleasure to have this big group together, all doing similar work, and that they would keep telling the other their associates what was happening, and they would learn. Somebody would say, well, you know, if you did this, it would solve that problem. So it was a good unity that we had. But we didn't have anybody on the outside telling us what to do. Or I would get to that. Of course, I knew what all the others were doing. So if there was something I could add that would help them, I would tell them about it. But it was their science and their research grants. The other important thing was that the chairman of our department, Frank Dixon, could not tell us one thing that we had to do. And we did much more science than he did. In fact, it's interesting that I never saw him do any science. I never saw him with a pipette in his hand or tubes with fluids in them, and he was adding things. He would sit back and watch everybody else.
Was he more of the manager, would you say? Is he in a managerial role?
Well, no, because he couldn't tell us what to do.
That's true.
He just had to keep the place alive. And he was not the most popular person in the building.
It sounds like you took your mentorship role quite seriously with your postdocs.
Oh, well, so that they would feel independent and they could learn things and be on so many research articles and publications that they would be offered positions as assistant professors when they went somewhere else.
And did that happen? Were they successful?
Oh, yes. Oh, they did. Yeah, it was really, really good.
How many postdocs passed through your lab over the years, do you know, roughly?
Over 100.
Wow, okay.
In fact, I forgot the exact date, but they all decided to come back and be with me and thank me for the time. And I had this, I have a picture of them. About 80 of them all came back to thank me for what they learned and did in the lab.
Do you remember when that was?
I think it was about 1999, right towards the end.
That's lovely.
And, you know, to see your postdoc, they, most of them didn't know each other, but they all got up in an auditorium, and each would present the work that he was now doing to the others, and it made them all feel good. But they didn't know each other. I remember one time at a lunch, somebody did this with the food, and then he got the food back. These are postdocs.
Right. Do some of them stand out in your minds that maybe they went on to something that you felt like you influenced them, or just someone you had a strong relationship with?
Oh, they all took the work they did in the lab and the knowledge they had in the lab and put that, they either kept that going or they would expand it into different areas. So that's what they did.
Yeah.
And they became professors and full professors, and all came, when they left the lab, they were all at least assistant professors.
Mm.
So they had a new, good life, just like I had had.
And did you keep in touch with some of them? I know all came back, but you continued to keep in touch. Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah, we were all not only scientific colleagues, we were friends and families. The families all knew each other. Many of them were not married when they arrived, but they were married after they left.
Well, I was going to ask, like, what was it like? Because Scripps is just getting started. It's pretty small. What is this area like? Is it built up? Does everyone know each other? Or you all live and work in the same... Does it feel like a very small, intimate community at this time?
We all knew each other, and we kind of kept an eye on what the others were doing. Because we were good friends. And the postdocs that they would bring in, we got to know them too. And the work they were doing. So that was a real pleasure.
Did people live in San Diego and commute, or are you living right around the Scripps campus?
Some would live up in Del Mar area,
uh-huh. Okay.
And then would come down. But in general, they lived in the area here.
Around La Jolla,
mm-hmm.
Somewhere, yeah.
And, you know, it was a pleasure having them come from different countries, or down from Seattle. I had several from Seattle and work in the lab. And I'd given talks up in Seattle, so they'd heard me, and that's one of the things that got them started.
And are they mostly men?
No, there were quite a few, well, mostly men, but there were quite a few women who came into this too. And they're in that picture.
When did you start to get more female postdocs coming in?
Immediately,
okay, yeah.
Because they weren't necessarily through medical school, they'd gotten PhDs. But in medical school, it took some time before more women were admitted, and they realized that women could make as good doctors as males, if not better.
And is it mostly white students that came through your lab, or?
Oh, I had a mixture.
That started to get more diverse too. Yeah.
But yeah. As in college, when I wanted to bring a new member of the fraternity, a black kid I'd met, gotten to know well on the campus, and they wouldn't accept it, which made me mad. Why not have a black guy, a member of the same fraternity? What's different about him besides skin? So I always really appreciated black students who did well.
Did you have any black students, postdocs that worked for you?
Yeah. Along with women.
Mm-hmm. Good. Dave, do you want to ask anything else about the postdocs or take a break before anything? How are you feeling?
I might say a couple of things about the growth of the Research Institute.
That's what I'm wondering. Do we want to do that now, or how's it going, Dave?
Well, so it depends on how much longer you want to go today, but there is something I realized before we started, we mentioned we were going to ask about, and then we forgot to ask about it. So I would want to return to that, just a brief thing.
I thought of that as well. So when I arrived here, I saw on your table this photograph that I believe Ansel Adams took of you at Rochester Medicine. Could you tell me a little bit more about why there's a photo of you from Ansel Adams?
Well, I was having a quick bite to eat in the cafe at the medical school because I was going to go to a 1 o'clock lecture that I wanted to hear. And while I was gobbling as fast as I could, this man who didn't have hair on top of his head came in and said, I'd like to take a picture of you. And I said, I'm sorry, but I've got a lecture I really want to go to. He said, well, it's for the university. I said, really? Well, if it's for the university, it's done a lot of good for me, so you can take that picture. So we went up to the surgical suites, and I had to strip down and put on surgical gowns, which is the first time I'd seen those things or wore them. And he took the pictures over an hour period of time. And then I said to him, listen, could I get a negative? Because then I can take a copy of the picture. And he laughed as hard as I've ever seen somebody laugh. Because all of his, I didn't know who he was, of course, but all of his negatives are held in vaults because they're so expensive.
Right.
And so he sent me a positive about a month. I said, well, could you? I said, for my family, who put me through school and paid for everything. And so he then sent me a positive, and that's where this made copies of that.
So they're gorgeous black and white photographs that he took of you and some of your colleagues in the lab.
Just me.
Okay, I thought these might have been.
Yeah, that's Whipple.
Okay.
One of the reasons I went to medical school there.
But they chose you on the cover of the Rochester Medicine. This is the fall-winter 2002 University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry publication, and we have Charlie on the cover from Ansel Adams. It's a beautiful photograph. I'm gonna pause it, Dave.
Start the recording again and just say that this is the second session. Also joining us is, so.